being at the front of a band has a certain responsibility. I felt I wanted to find out about other aspects of music, you know, and, you know, learn about other areas, about playing with other people.
It's tough doing that stuff. It really is tough because there's no guarantee that it will work. It takes a lot of blood, sweat and tears to make those things work usually. When we get together, there can be miles of musical difference.
Hi, this is Steve Winwood.
Welcome back. I'm Eric Clapton with Redbeard
in the studio.
I'm Redbeard, the legendary Blind Faith Project. Recorded and released as a single studio album in August 1969, Blind Faith did one ill-fated U.S. tour that fall and quickly broke up. Nevertheless, rock's first supergroup, as Time magazine Rock Press bestowed on Blind Faith, has long held a mysterious attraction because the two principals, Eric Clapton and Steve Winwood, chose not to discuss it for many years until recently. The two reconnected on stage at Clapton's 2007 Crossroads Festival in Chicago that year, and it went over so well that they decided to perform three full nights in February 2008 at the scene of Blind Faith's first American gig, that being New York City's Madison Square Garden. But early in 1969, after two critically hailed Traffic albums, a very young Steve Winwood had already tired of wrestling with another ambitious Traffic member, Dave Mason, and Winwood went to seek out a less competitive, more collaborative, laid-back environment. On paper, at least, Steve Winwood admits that his R&B sound in the Spencer Davis group and the pastoral rhythmic Traffic didn't really share all that much with Eric Clapton's recorded output at the time, with John Mayall, the Yardbirds, or Cream. Here's Steve Winwood with me in the studio.
I think what you're hinting at there, Redbeard, is the kind of influences within Traffic, perhaps, where, you know, Traffic has always had hinted at a kind of Latin thing rather than a straight ahead rock and roll. The groove has always been important, and we've drawn on our influences of, you know, whether it be, you know, Memphis music of the 60s or, you know, English country music or classical music or jazz, or and melody is very important, absolutely. The stuff that he was listening to and that we were both listening to, and that was really what, that's something that I suppose in the first instance that brought us together, is that we actually listened to the same kind of music and got certain things out of music that we listened to, and that was a very important part.
Return, not today, will be welcome.
But the twin guitar interplay of Eric Clapton and Steve Winwood on Blind Faith's Had to Cry Today was a musical signpost pointing toward what Clapton would do soon after Blind Faith with his now legendary guitar duels with Duane Allman in Derek and the Dominoes. Clapton went on to collaborate in supporting George Harrison's comeback in the 90s, an award-winning album with B.B. King, and two recent projects, one with J.J. Cale and the other with Johnny Winter, before both of those passed away. But Blind Faith was Eric Clapton's first and possibly most daunting musical summit meeting.
It's tough doing that stuff. It really is tough because there's no guarantee that it will work. It takes a lot of blood, sweat, and tears to make those things work, usually. Because as much as we all have our connection and our origins in the same place, you know, that we all come from Robert Johnson or whoever it is that inspired us, when we get together, there can be miles of musical difference that, you know, the outside ear won't see. But the actual experience of meeting head up can be quite difficult. You know, you have to make a lot of compromises and you've got to bend your thing this way and that to before it will fit, you know. I do sessions like this and it's always the same. There, I mean, even with a person that would be of my same thinking and temperament, I mean, even say if I, you know, when Robert and I worked together on Journeyman, there is still that bridge to cross between one individual's way of seeing the music and the others. And I put this to the test too much sometimes, I think. And for me, in my fantasy head, I can see a way of doing it. I see how it can be done in here, in my head. But you give me the guitar and then play back the track and tell me I've got to just do what I feel is right. I have no idea. And I was surprised by the outcome. So it's really risky sometimes. It can be very frustrating.
I don't doubt anything that you just said. And at the same time, it's a great compliment to you. If you weren't truly there for the music and malleable to fit in with the music, they wouldn't invite you.
Mm. I think you're right, yeah. I think you're right. I think it's because I have a sense, a really inbuilt sense of debt to the music and to the support and love of other of my peers and colleagues, you know. Because we do, many of us really do care about one another, and when we do well, we pat one another on the back, and that's what keeps us going. More than anything else, is the love of our comrades, you know. And I work on that sense of debt, you know, that I do owe my existence and my achievements in this business to the help of all the other guys. Really,
it's nice to hear.
Yeah,
that's good.
You can't do it on your own, man. No way.
Winwood composition Can't Find My Way Home, done by Blind Faith, has become a legitimate classic since first heard on the Blind Faith album in 1969.
This is Steve Winwood.
Welcome back. I'm Eric Clapton with Redbeard.
In the studio.
Thank you both, gentlemen. It's an honor. In his best-selling 2007 autobiography, Eric Clapton reminds us that Blind Faith did not start as a band at all. Despite his credentials, Clapton, like Steve Winwood, was actually not looking to start another band.
Because when I was with Cream, I was very young, and I wasn't particularly taking much notice of what was going on, to be honest with you. I was in my own little world, and just a guitar player with a rock band. The time that we existed and were working and touring, we didn't have all this mania that exists now for the 60s. Cream was really just a little known band from England, sort of slightly less, well, in fact, a lot less known than The Who. And we weren't really aware of what we were. I mean, and I especially wasn't particularly aware of how good the songwriting was. I just was all these songs were just vehicles for me to play riffs in and play solos. And when the Cream broke up and time went by, that all, you know, was another, just to me, gone. You know, gone stuff, gone in the past. And I hope as time goes by, other things will come up like that, you know, because it's not always good to play songs which you have your own series of reasons to play. It's actually nice to get inside someone else's skin and see what they like about it, you know, see what they like about it. So you can just look at it afresh, really.
reimagine Buddy Holly's Well, All Right on their 1969 album. But the fact that they had to resort to a cover song plus a 15-minute jam to fill up their album points to business forces outside the Blind Faith band members serving up a hasty pudding before its time. Eric Clapton has always had a clear philosophy on interpreting the work of other songwriters.
I mean, sometimes the versions of songs that you really love have to be left alone. You know, it maybe that's it. Maybe that, you know, the best covers should be better than the originals, shouldn't they? Really? What's the point unless you can improve it?
You're right.
Unless you just want to make a few bucks.
No, you're right.
If you're paying a tribute, it's really got to be better, or an advancement, or a kind of evolution of what was originally there. Most people, I think, would do covers of songs that were lesser known, or, you know, were obscure by their very nature. So therefore, when they get the cover and they get the hit, you know, there's nothing to compare it to. I mean, I had the fortune with that, with I Shot the Sheriff. I mean, I had the, that was a cover and it was a hit, but no one knew about Bob Marley's version until after.
In his autobiography, Eric Clapton tells that the tipping point for the formation of Blind Faith came one night when Clapton was visiting Steve Winwood in the latter's remote Berkshire Downs cottage, when a knock on the door found Clapton's ex-cream mate, drummer Ginger Baker. Steve's face lit up when he saw Ginger, while my heart sank, writes Clapton. Ginger's appearance frightened me because I felt that all of a sudden we'd be a band, and with that would come the whole Robert Stigwood machine and all the hype that had surrounded Cream, end quote.
I mean, I never really counted myself as a pop musician to begin with. It was something that slipped into my life time and again, you know, that you know, I would toy with it. But it never really was a serious option to me. I mean, making music has always been a series of changes and explorations for me that have nothing to do with trend, nothing to do with saleability, really. It's really me discovering me. It depends, really, your reasons for getting into this in the first place have a lot to do with it. I think a lot of people who came into it as pop musicians didn't expect to be working in this business after the age of 35. They didn't expect to. And for them to be enjoying, you know, a sort of second wind is quite a surprise to them, because it's, you know, they really didn't set out to make it a life's work. I don't think they thought of it in the long term. I did. You know, I did, because...
Honestly?
Honestly. I thought that I'd be doing this forever, because my heroes were all old men anyway, you know. By the time I got around to ever meeting them, there were old men who were still practicing their craft, and that to me was the ideal. I didn't ever think of it as something I would do until I was 25 and then quit. But a lot of people did. A lot of people branched out, became businessmen in the publishing world, or became, you know, producers, or became, you know, executives in the business, staying in touch, but not necessarily playing. Well, I mean, no, they're not bad. I'm not going to say these are bad reasons. I mean,
but just there were other things
to have fun would be a good enough reason.
And get paid for it.
To have fun and get paid for it and get laid and
like
travel and all these things.
Sounds like a great job to me.
Very appealing, and not take it too seriously. See? Not take it too seriously. And then when the popularity starts to wane, you find a sort of a secure way of get a real job, a proper job.
One of the musical highlights of the Blind Faith album is Steve Winwood's Sea of Joy. Still to come, the ill-fated U.S. tour reveals Blind Faith alone to be insufficient, while lessons learned stop just short of bridges burned. I'm Redbeard with Eric Clapton and Steve Winwood in the studio on Blind Faith's anniversary.
This is Steve Winwood.
Welcome back. I'm Eric Clapton with Redbeard.
In the studio.
Thanks again, gentlemen. The Blind Faith Project occurred amidst a lot of firsts for Eric Clapton, from stardom to some wealth, from independence to complicated adult relationships. Clapton wrote a song inspired by his first manor home, known as Hurtwood, calling the song Presence of the Lord. Blind Faith singer Steve Winwood picked up on that sentiment.
I think there's an element of, you know, soul searching, which, you know, and perhaps with a kind of spiritual searching, perhaps, that we feel, which we've arrived at, or in from various directions, or from at various times. And I think a lot of people do arrive at, they ask questions that, even if they have, you know, the strongest faith imaginable, that they still ask questions, or to themselves, why is this? And, you know, and I think that in many respects there's a spiritual element that is lacking in a lot of what goes on in the world today. And so if we can help in some whatever small way to help anybody see that, or recognize it, or question themselves spiritually, then we feel that it's a job well done.
Though Presence of the Lord by Blind Faith was written by Eric Clapton, the singer Steve Winwood, soon after Blind Faith disbanded and he returned to Traffic, would have his own spiritual epiphany after a bout of appendicitis in 1972, turned to life-threatening when he developed deadly peritonitis and almost died. The experience had a profound effect on Steve Winwood.
It enabled me to take advantage of a lot of things that maybe I hadn't done. I was only interested before that in music, and nothing else ever interested me. After that, I started to come out of myself a bit more, I think, and want to meet people and want to learn about other things which I'd never learned about or known about. I still loved music and wanted to play music more than anything else, but I think I found that I'd got into a bit of a rut. I mean, Traffic was a fantastic unit and a great band, and I was with some of the greatest people in it, that, you know, real good friends and people that would never let you down. But being at the front of a band has a certain responsibility, and I felt I wanted to find out about other aspects of music, you know, and, you know, learn about other areas, about playing with other people.
You seem to be a convincing case that maturity brings with it really a freedom and an independence that we formerly thought possible, you know, only on the rebellious or reckless side of rock and roll. How do you do that?
Well, I think, you know, maturity should want to bring about an improvement. It does in everything else. You know, it does if you're, you know, a painter or a broadcaster or an athlete, or, you know, I mean, you know, a certain amount of maturity means experience to cope with certain, you know, to cope better with your job. It should be. You're quite right. There is a slight kind of dichotomy between growing old and rock and roll. But you see, I think that, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, I find rock and roll very hard to define exactly. It's just another label which gets attached to music, and I've never, you know. And then also through the 60s, there were all kinds of social changes which were involved with rock and roll, and they've hung on, and it seems to be representative of social behavior.
Always was linked to that.
Yes.
Always was.
Always was. And from my point of view, although I was loosely involved in that kind of way, I mean, my involvement has always been with music. Rock and roll is just getting broader. I mean, I think as you mature, you do modify what you do very, very slightly, subtly. For instance, there are artists who maybe are more involved with the visual side of rock and roll and that kind of thing, who probably might, as they mature, might move into acting a little more. So as they mature, then they would probably have to veer into maybe, you know, the visual arts, or, you know, drama or some films or something like that. And similarly, when I started, there was a lot of standing on stage and shaking, and, you know, but then, you know, I kind of veered towards music a little bit more, production, and then and used it also as a learning process. You know, I'm certainly not doing the same thing that I was doing when I was, you know, 17 on stage. But, I mean, it's not, I've tried to encapsulate what I did, but maybe try and present it in a way that can give maybe a little more, something else in addition to that.
Eric Clapton has found that his illustrious half-century career has had the unintended consequences of amassing the favorite songs now of several generations, including the brief Blind Faith.
See, my head is like a mental jukebox, and there's so much stuff in there. And it's very tempting. I mean, I sometimes get a mental block, and other times it's just like stuff comes out just for fun, you know, that I want to play. I do stuff like that every night. But, I mean, there's a time and a place, and they've got to go, some of these songs. And so that's the problem. That's the problem you face, is what do you fill the space with? You know, what are you changing with? I think, in a sense, you owe those songs to be performed. And I'm very anal about it. I don't want to let them go, you know. And they've evolved, and so it's like, how do you do it? How do you do it without going into like 3 and 4 hour sets? So that, you know, you've got your new material and you're also paying tribute to the older stuff and trying to do things that everyone wants to hear and everyone wants to play. And so when I got time to put that tour together, the first thing that came to me was, the first thing I wanted to do was to dress up the songs, you know, just see how they would take shape. And I was really interested to see if they were going to change, how they would change, etc., etc. So those were the priorities. And then just to fill round them, to really go through that sort of long, long map of my history and sort out which songs everybody enjoyed. You know, see, that's always important to me, is to find out from everyone in the band what the consensus is on my older material. And it's really quite surprising what they come up with, the things that, I mean, they won't let me drop Can't Find My Way Home.
Come down off your throne and leave your
spectacular performance of Can't Find My Way Home by Eric Clapton and Steve Winwood in 2008 at Madison Square Garden, the same venue which saw Blind Faith's first U.S. concert in 1969. That tour was fraught with production problems. Even crowds rioted. But the 2008 Clapton-Winwood tour brought a resolution to those difficult times. Here's Steve Winwood.
Yeah, I don't tour an awful lot, and touring is something I do because I feel not just because I like to play in front of people, and I like to it's a different kind of medium from making a record. Although I prefer being in the studio, that is what I like to do best. But having said that, you know, playing live can be very fulfilling. And I think that after so long of being in the studio and not probably not having played in America for a long time, it was very moving to be received like that, you know, by the audiences. You know, people can tell you, people in the business or the record company will say, "Yeah, this is a great record," or you know. But, you know, when you actually get it on stage, that's when you really know that you've done something good.
This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking my guests, Eric Clapton and Steve Winwood. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions. Copyright 2014, all rights reserved. Transcription, Jane Carpenter Brunet. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and for more, stay at inthestudio.net.